coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. An activist group says the number of Assyrian Christians kidnapped by Islamic State militants in northeastern Syria has risen to at least 220. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the fighters captured people during the past three days as they took control of 10 villages. The Islamic State group has targeted religious minorities with kidnappings and killings during its spread across northern Iraq and Syria. Earlier this week, the U.S. State Department called for the immediate release of the kidnapped Assyrian Christians. Witnesses in Somalia say one person was killed by at least five mortar rounds fired Thursday at the presidential palace in Mogadishu. Security officials confirmed the attack but did not release any information on casualties. Police say they are investigating. Militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for the attack and said several shells landed inside the palace, a detail not confirmed by security forces. Russia is warning Western countries against imposing more sanctions on Moscow, saying such threats show the West is opposed to following through on a truce for eastern Ukraine. Both the United States and some leaders in Europe have threatened to impose tougher sanctions on Moscow if it does not stop supporting pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on Thursday called those threats an attempt to deflect attention from the need to follow through on the terms of a ceasefire. Ukraine's military announced it has begun pulling 100-millimeter weapons from the front lines in eastern Ukraine. This is VOA News. The United States says it is very concerned about a new report that predicts North Korea will expand its nuclear stockpile to as many as 100 weapons by 2020. Analysts there say it may be disagreements over Pyongyang's nuclear capabilities, but there is no doubt the weapons program poses a growing international threat. VOA's Brian Padden reports from Seoul.
Experts on nuclear weapons technology at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies estimate that North Korea currently has 10 to 16 nuclear weapons and is continuing to work on its nuclear program. Depending on the rate of production, they predict Pyongyang will expand its nuclear arsenal from 20 to 100 weapons in the next 5 years. South Korea Defense Ministry spokesman Kim Min-seok disputed the group's claims about North Korea's current capability. He says the analysis that North Korea has 10 to 16 nuclear weapons is just an assumption by some private groups and experts, and there is no evidence to support this. Brian Padden, VOA News, Seoul.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said on Wednesday Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is wrong in his judgment of nuclear talks with Iran. Prime Minister Netanyahu told fellow Likud party members Wednesday that by making concessions to the Iranians, the United States and its partners have given up on their commitment to keep Iran from being able to build a nuclear weapon. Kerry told a congressional hearing that what has been accomplished so far in talks with Iran has actually made Israel safer by stopping Iran from advancing its nuclear program. The Obama administration is extremely upset that Republican House Speaker John Boehner invited Mr. Netanyahu to speak to a joint meeting of Congress next week without informing Democrats, and that the prime minister has accepted. A Taliban suicide bomber rammed his explosives-packed vehicle into a Turkish embassy convoy in the Afghan capital Thursday morning, killing at least two people. Spokesman for Kabul police tells VOA a Turkish national was among those killed in the attack that took place just outside the Turkish mission in central Kabul. The U.S. Federal Communications Commission will vote Thursday on a proposal that would ensure the nation's internet sector operates as a free and open marketplace. The commissioners were expected to approve a proposal offered by Chairman Tom Wheeler that would ban so-called paid prioritization, which big internet service providers would charge content providers a higher fee to stream their material over cyberspace faster than smaller customers. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Hundreds of women and children shelter under trees in desperate conditions. More than 300 families who fled recent fighting from surrounding villages are here, now displaced with nowhere else to go. They have little food and more than an hour's walk to the closest water source.
That's reporter Adam Bales talking about the displacement of hundreds of thousands of people in South Sudan's Kordofan state. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the World Health Organization says new Ebola cases continue to be reported, but health officials are not sure how some of the patients became infected. And Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf speaks to Washington officials later this hour. We'll carry her speech live when it happens.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Story this hour, a military spokesman says the Niger Air Force bombed a convoy of trucks hauling smoked fish on the Nigerian border yesterday. The bombings are an attempt to choke off revenues of Boko Haram militants from Nigeria, whose terrorist attacks recently have been targeting the Lake Chad region. Security officials say Boko Haram levies taxes on the fish traders or seizes their catch to sell to support the cost of their five-year campaign to build a caliphate in northern Nigeria. In response, the governor of Niger's Diffa region this week banned the sale and transport of fish into Nigeria.
In other related news, a Nigerian general who returned from the besieged barracks town of Baga said yesterday it is safe for residents to return. Nigerian troops fled a Boko Haram attack there last month when hundreds of residents were reported killed by the militants. Lieutenant General Kenneth Minimia says Nigerian troops have seen victory and more towns will be taken in Nigeria's north. Minimia echoes the claim of other Nigerian officials, including President Goodluck Jonathan, who said yesterday that the tide is turning against Boko Haram in Nigeria. Mr. Jonathan faces stiff competition for re-election on March 28th against a former Nigerian president, Muhammadu Buhari. The violence also forced the government to postpone an April election date.
An activist group says the number of Assyrian Christians kidnapped by Islamic State militants in northeastern Syria has risen to at least 220. In addition to those kidnapped in the province, activists say many more have fled from their homes to the main cities of Hasake and Kamishli. Kurdish fighters backed by days of airstrikes from a U.S.-led military coalition also have been battling the militants in the area.
Earlier this week, the U.S. State Department called for the immediate release of the kidnapped Assyrian Christians. Spokeswoman Jean Pesky said ISIL's latest targeting of a religious minority is only further testament to its brutal and inhumane treatment of all those who disagree with its divisive goals and toxic beliefs.
Many armed and terror groups are being funded through the illegal ivory trade, but there is a new tool to combat the poachers. Scientists in Bangkok are now able to trace where tusks come from. Traffic, the Wildlife Trade Monitoring Network, is testing the DNA in ivory tusks that have been seized or sold in local markets. It's found that most tusks being traded in Thailand are coming from elephants killed in Africa. Tom Milliken is the leader of Traffic's Elephant and Rhino Monitoring Program from Harare, Zimbabwe. He spoke to VOA's David Arnold about the impact of the DNA test in Africa.
This is a critical issue for Thailand because they have a long-standing allowance for ivory that derives from captive Asian elephants. There are many captive elephants in Thailand. Thailand is a range state for Asian elephants, and there is a traditional culture of people who own elephants, work elephants in the timber industry originally and sometimes for transportation. The ivory from these registered animals can be sold as products on local markets. But for a long time, we have very we've been quite adamant in saying that most of the ivory in the Thai market is really derivative of African elephants, and that Thailand is a country of concern in the illegal ivory trade from Africa to Asia.
The results of those tests showed that most of the elephants do come from Africa. Is that right?
That's right. A majority of the findings were positive for African elephants. Only ivory from Asian elephants is eligible for retail sale. The timing in all of this is very, very important.
Why is the timing important?
This registration process is going on. Anybody in possession of ivory, I think by the 21st of April, 2015, everything has to be registered with the Thai government.
Practically speaking, how does that affect your job in reducing trafficking of ivory from elephants in Africa?
Actually, we believe that Thailand is probably the second largest unregulated ivory market now, and increasingly Thailand has been under a lot of pressure through the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. Thailand was requested to enact new legislation to really decisively deal with the country's inability to police African elephant ivory in their local markets or face sanctions. We have seen an unprecedented commitment. New legislation has come forward, and if Thailand is no longer a major destination for African elephant ivory, I think we're definitely going to see some improvement in the situation here in Africa.
The key to this seems to be the discipline of the law enforcement agencies in Thailand in applying these new regulations.
That's right. I mean, our partner in all of this is the Department of National Parks, and they are the ones who are spearheading this registration and will be in a position going forward, to make arrests, impose fines, or imprison. Failure to register ivory on the part of commercial dealers, you could end up with a fine of 6 million baht, which is roughly $200,000, or imprisonment of up to 3 years. So there is a lot of bite in the penal code.
Do you see a decline in ivory poaching in Africa based on these events?
The hope is that we're going to see a much greater decline in both levels of illegal killing and illegal ivory trade.
That was Traffic's Tom Milliken from Harare. He spoke with VOA's David Arnold.
Heavy fighting in Sudan's South Kordofan state is causing hundreds of thousands to flee into uncertain conditions. Local aid organizations estimate as many as 400,000 civilians have been internally displaced since the conflict began more than 3 years ago, while another 250,000 have fled across the border to refugee camps in South Sudan. Adam Bales traveled on both sides of the border and reports on another looming humanitarian crisis.
Hundreds of women and children shelter under trees in desperate conditions. More than 300 families who fled recent fighting from surrounding villages are here, now displaced with nowhere else to go. They have little food and more than an hour's walk to the closest water source. In Tulodi County, the eastern frontline village of Ungatu is destroyed. Intensified fighting last month displaced more than 10,000 people in just a few days, adding to the growing number of Nuban Sudanese displaced by more than 3 years of civil war. These people are still not safe. Though the Sudanese government denies targeting civilians, communities live in danger of continuous shelling and Antonov bomber attacks. Even here, they say they are still at risk of being reached by Sudan's government guns.
We left our homes because of the bombardment. We left everything at home. We had just a little bit of food, but have finished it. We're living without anything to eat or drink. We're living with the shelling and Antonov attacks day and night.
We have been here for 12 days. We are staying here without food and without water. We cannot sleep in the day or night because the shelling does not stop.
SPLA North rebels later took back the village, but Ungartu, recently home to 5,000 people, now lies empty. Food stores looted, houses burned, buildings flattened by shelling and bombing. Casings litter the ground from thousands of bullets fired. Mohammed Al Sabai, Tulodi County's commissioner, says everything was burned when government troops took the village.
The civilians have been displaced because of the attack of the enemy shelling and aerial bombardment from Antonov. Ungartu was full of civilians before the National Congress Party attacked the area.
Since the start of the war, the Sudanese government has banned all international relief and humanitarian aid in South Kordofan. With this ban in place, the thousands internally displaced within Sudan's borders will receive no help. Despite this, many families refuse to leave the country. Rebel commander Abu Ras Kuku says if human rights were being observed here, this would not happen.
The Sudanese government is targeting civilians. If they were only fighting with the SPLA, we would not have a problem. But the thing is that they target civilians, and that is a violation of human rights. So it is unacceptable to shell and bomb civilians. That is a war crime.
In Ungartu village, SPLA North rebels walk us through what remains of the communities emptied by heavy fighting. For now, forces wait on standby. The families here do not want to leave their land, but with their homes destroyed and nowhere else to go, their future here is uncertain. Adam Bales for VOA News, Ungartu, Sudan.
Seventeen minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. New studies show programs that use antiretroviral drugs to prevent HIV infection are very effective. The findings were released this week at the Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections in Seattle, Washington. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Using HIV-suppressing drugs as a prevention method is called PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis. Supporters say it's a powerful tool to help stop the spread of the AIDS virus. Mitchell Warren, head of the AIDS advocacy group AVAC, attended the conference known as CROI.
Over the last 5 years, there is a growing body of evidence that oral pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, is not just good therapy, but it's good prevention, with the important caveat that like any effective drug, it only works if you take it.
Warren says three PrEP trials prove the effectiveness of Truvada.
That is the combination pill of tenofovir plus emtricitabine. Most of the research has been around Truvada. It's a well-established drug. We know it's a very safe drug. It was widely used in antiretroviral therapy for people infected. So it was the first of the drugs that have been explored for PrEP. There are other drugs being studied for PrEP.
One of the trials is called the Partners Demonstration Project. It's based on an earlier study in Kenya and Uganda of so-called discordant heterosexual couples. That's where one partner is HIV positive and the other is not.
This was a project that enrolled new couples, a very large number of couples in the two countries, and it was offering treatment to the HIV-positive partner. But if the partner didn't want to be on treatment, or if they were on treatment but not yet virally suppressed, which would give protection to their negative partner as well, the PrEP was provided to the HIV-negative partner as a bridge until the positive partner was virally suppressed.
The study shows the use of PrEP reduced the risk of HIV infection by 96%. Next, there's the PROUD study. It was done in Britain among high-risk men who have sex with men, or MSM. All in the study were HIV negative.
One of the important questions of the PROUD study was, would people change their behavior? You know, one of the big concerns over the last several years was that if everyone kind of ran to PrEP, they'd abandon condoms, they would change their behaviors and be riskier. This was another piece of great news. It showed that there was an 86% reduction in risk amongst those people who were offered and took PrEP.
Warren says the PROUD study also shows there was a similar reduction in risk from other STIs, or sexually transmitted infections. The third trial, called Ypres Gay, took place in France and Canada. It enrolled MSM, who reported having frequent sex. It, too, shows an 86% reduction in risk.
But this was a different study. They were trying to see if a different dosing schedule might also be effective. Rather than telling people to take it every day, what the participants in this trial were told was to take two pills within the 24-hour period before you think you might have sex. And if you do have sex, you should then take another pill 24 hours after having sex, and then another pill 24 more hours later. So it's basically four pills within 3 days.
Warren says for the findings to have an effect in the real world, there needs to be an action plan that includes resources and research agendas. He says the focus should be on those most at risk, especially young African women.
One of the things about science presented at CROI is that it's often very elegant science, but it doesn't have any impact on the epidemic if you don't act on the science. The drug Truvada that is used for PrEP right now is only approved for use as prevention in one country, the United States, and there is an urgency and, frankly, a moral imperative that the drug get registered as a preventive tool in many, many more countries.
The AVAC leader cautions PrEP is not for everyone. Efficacy trials continue for effective vaginal gels or rings containing antiretrovirals, as well as injectable ARVs taken every 2 to 3 months. Vaccine trials also continue. Also at CROI, Doctors Without Borders released the findings of its HIV studies. The group, also known as MSF, says among individuals not receiving antiretroviral treatment, men had twice the level of HIV virus in their blood as women at the same stage in the disease. It says a high viral load greatly increases the risk of infection. MSF says the findings help explain why incidence is so high among women and that it could be critical to test and treat men even earlier. The studies were done in Kenya, Malawi, and South Africa. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The World Health Organization says in the 7-day period ending February 22nd, there were 99 new confirmed cases of Ebola in West Africa. 63 were in Sierra Leone. Guinea reported 35 new infections, and Liberia just one. Meanwhile, three more health workers are reported to be infected with Ebola, two in Guinea and the other in Sierra Leone. Since the outbreak began, 837 health workers have been infected and 490 have died. Overall, there have been well over 25,000 Ebola cases and more than 9,500 reported deaths. Officials say the actual death toll could be higher.
The preventable eye disease trachoma can be found in over 50 countries, with most being in Africa and the Middle East. It is also found in countries in the Americas and Asia. The Atlanta-based Carter Center's Trachoma Control Program has been working in these countries to implement a strategy to reduce and ultimately eradicate trachoma, especially in Ethiopia, where the disease is most endemic. Kelly Callahan is the director of the Carter Center's Trachoma Control Program. She explained why women and girls suffer from the disease more so than any other group of people.
Women are the caretakers of the children, so it's just natural that children are in closer proximity to their mothers during their formative years, especially between the ages of 6 months, 5, before they start going to school. So as they're grouped together, the women and the children, there's usually multiple children, and they are therefore then transmitting repeated episodes of infection between each other in a much tighter fashion because they're grouped together in a tighter way. And this, unfortunately, impacts girls greatly as well, because oftentimes girls don't have the opportunity to go to school, given that they have to stay and be caretakers as well.
What are some programs that are underway right now that are working to reduce trachoma?
Kim, this disease, trachoma, has a strategy. It's a four-pillar strategy called the SAFE strategy. It's surgery for eyelids that have started to turn, antibiotics for prevention of the eyelids turning, face washing facial cleanliness, as we call it, to teach people to keep their faces clean, and then environmental improvement, that's building latrines and helping people keep their compounds clean and clear of human feces. So this disease requires repeated episodes of infection over time, and the way that happens is through a fly. The fly breeds on human feces. So if we help people build latrines, this fly only likes to build on human feces in the open air. So if there's plenty of latrines, this fly will not have a place to breathe. So it will greatly reduce the transmission of this disease and therefore then prevent this disease. The other factor about this fly is it likes to land on the eye and nose discharge, and it uses that eye and nose discharge as nourishment. And that's actually how this disease is transmitted. One of the ways, besides fingers and hands and towels, flies are the biggest form of transmission. So if people have facial cleanliness, if their face is clean, they won't have as many flies in the area because the fly won't have the nourishment to continue to breed.
Also, your preventive strategy, you're doing this in several countries in Africa, including Ethiopia, Mali, Niger, Nigeria, Sudan, South Sudan, and Uganda. But I also understand that Ethiopia does have the highest known cases of active trachoma. Why is that?
Ethiopia, particularly a region called the Amhara region, which is where the Carter Center works, has the highest known concentration of blinding trachoma. There's 22 million people that live in the Amhara region. The country of Ethiopia has approximately 80 million people. In the areas that we're talking about, particularly the Amhara region, this is the poorest of the poor. These people do not have access to latrines. They do not have access to safe water. They live in a manner that is very resource poor. They don't have much. And in not having much, they suffer from the neglected tropical diseases in a higher rate of density and a higher rate of prevalence than anywhere else, particularly in blinding trachoma.
In my recent visit to regions of Ethiopia where trachoma is endemic, I saw how women there, young women, were very empowered and mobilized to educate their communities on preventing trachoma and on the safe strategy. Is this really working as it should, or is there something else that should be done as well?
No, Kim, I think an important aspect of this program is environmental improvement and building and using latrines. That not only combats and prevents trachoma, it also works towards other diseases like diarrheal diseases for children under five and mortality for children under five, also for cholera and for other worms that people get, particularly in Ethiopia.
That was Kelly Callahan, Director of Trachoma Control Program at the Carter Center. She spoke with me from Atlanta, Georgia.
And we have a program reminder. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf speaks to Washington officials later this hour. We'll carry her speech live when it happens. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria kills thousands of people each year, but there are some simple things you can do to protect your family. If you can, put screens in your windows. A simple screen can keep disease-carrying mosquitoes out of your home. If you go outside, wear light-colored clothing and long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. After it rains, empty all containers of standing water. The water in just one discarded tire can become a breeding ground for thousands of mosquitoes. Make sure your home is clear of debris and anything that holds water, including discarded cans, water containers, and rubbish. Empty containers that livestock drink from regularly so that Mosquitoes cannot breed there.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. An activist group says the number of Assyrian Christians kidnapped by Islamic State militants in northeastern Syria has risen to at least 220. The World Health Organization says new Ebola cases continue to be reported, but health officials are not sure how some of the patients became infected. Coming up, we'll have music from Ghana, and in our feature segment, traditional communities, local land rights, and the economics of tourism and conservation in Kenya. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand a young basketball star is hitting nothing but net on the court and in the fight against malaria.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to Stephon Curry, the Golden State Warriors All-Star guard, who is using his stellar basketball shooting ability in support of the fight against malaria. The 26-year-old Curry was here in Washington Wednesday, and he met with U.S. President Barack Obama at the White House to discuss the Nothing But Nets anti-malaria campaign. For the past three NBA seasons, Curry has donated three insecticide-treated mosquito nets for every three-point shot he makes during games. And Curry, one of the NBA's premier long-distance shooters, has made more than a few three-point shots. In fact, 2 years ago, Curry set the record for NBA three-point shots, as we hear now from Lawrence Scott of Golden State Warriors TV.
Stephen Curry's record season for three-pointers means it's a banner year for Nothing But Nets, a global campaign of the United Nations Foundation dedicated to the fight against the spread of malaria. And for each of his single-season NBA record for three-pointers made, 272 of them, he donated three life-saving bed nets.
It was approached by the UN Foundation and Nothing But Nets to help, you know, the cause, and we came up with the idea of, you know, three-point shots, is donate three nets for every shot I make. And you know, thankfully, we picked the right year. Obviously, the record and trying to get as much, you know, publicity towards the effort as possible is a good year.
Nothing But Nets was founded by renowned sports journalist and author Rick Riley, who loves how Steph has helped pitch in.
His shot is as pure as his heart. That's what I love about him. You know, he's a fantastic dead-eye shooter, but he's really got his eye on the prize here, which is to try to save kids from dying of malaria, and he really gets it. And, you know, you got to have fun to get people interested, and you got to have heroes, and he's our hero.
You just try to use your platform the best you can. And, you know, a lot of people watch our games and may not be as aware of the problem of malaria and how preventable it is. And, you know, we raise a lot of money, and we can't thank, you know, the fans and people who supported it enough for all they did this year as well.
So far this year, Stephen Curry has made 170 three-point shots, and he's proven to be one of the main offensive weapons for the Warriors, who lead the NBA with a record of 44 wins and 10 losses. And the man President Obama describes as the best shooter he's ever seen also won the three-point shooting contest in New York City during the NBA's recent All-Star weekend. On the humanitarian front, Stephen Curry has been active in malaria issues since he attended Davidson College in North Carolina. In 2013, Curry traveled to Tanzania as part of the Nothing But Nets campaign, and he helped distribute 38,000 bed nets.
This is Dikembe Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.
We are now interrupting our regular programming to go live now to, as Liberia's President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf will address officials here in Washington on her first official visit to Washington since declaring a state of emergency in her country to deal with the Ebola outbreak.
But though Liberia had succeeded at that moment when many other democracies, emerging democracies, had failed, Liberia still harbored deep and painful divisions following its long and brutal civil war. And in the audience before her that day were many opposition leaders who only days before had been vocally resisting the election's results and who had fought many as leaders in different factions of the Civil War. What President Sirleaf did that day, I will never forget. She spoke of the importance of democracy, of unity, of healing and reconciliation.
You're now listening to Senator Chris Coons, who will shortly be introducing President Sirleaf.
She walked to the front of the stage when she was finished with her speech and called up the opposition leaders and invited them to step forward and by embracing her to demonstrate to the people of Liberia that democracy had been embraced and the election was over and the nation would move forward. There was a moment of great tension and silence as she stood there with her arms open to the crowd, and a whole group of security folks surrounded Secretary Clinton. And there was a longer and longer and more tense moment as she simply stood there bravely. And then slowly, first one, then two, then three, almost like schoolboys, the opposition leaders, challenged by the courage of her stance, came forward and embraced her. It was a remarkable moment. At a time when others might have celebrated their own electoral triumph or tried to relegate their opponents to the sidelines, she elevated them. When some might have used the opportunity to exert their authority, she knew the job she'd been elected to do could not be done alone, and that building a Liberia that genuinely works for all Liberians, that heals, that unites, that is free and equal, that building that country would take the dedication of many, including her most recent opponents. And so it was, to many of us, little surprise in this past year when, as Ebola ravaged Liberia's communities and terrified not just the people of Liberia and Guinea and Sierra Leone, but much of the world, and threatened the survival of its young democracy in Liberia, that President Sirleaf did not just step up to the task, but was more than capable of embracing the task. Throughout our relationship, she's also inspired me with her demonstrations of humility, which are all too rare, I think, amongst elected leaders these days. One of the hardest things for leaders to do is to ask for help. They tend to think doing so is a sign of weakness, but the truth is what it really signals is dedication and strength. Dedication to service, to solutions, to saving the lives of those who desperately need help. And while she works now tirelessly to continue stabilizing her nation, she retains a powerful focus on the future, as should we. That was made clear to me during my visit in December, because as she talked with gratitude about the impact that American troops and volunteers and resources had made on turning Liberia away from crisis, she was clear that unless our aid translated into lasting investments with Liberians in Liberian capabilities, resilience, and recovery, we would not build a truly stronger Liberia together. Friends, as Nancy described, we have come a long way in the fight against Ebola. It is not over. Some of the hardest work remains in getting to zero and in rebuilding a robust and capable public health system for Liberia. But the people of Liberia have accomplished this, and they have shown an unwavering resilience and fortitude that I think is exemplified profoundly by their great elected leader. There are so many here and around the world who deserve thanks and credit, especially all the humanitarian organizations who are represented, but no one deserves our praise, in my view, more than President Sirleaf. Her dedication, humility, and foresight are trademarks of a leader I am honored to call a friend. So now please allow me to introduce my friend and Liberia's leader, Her Excellency Ellen Johnson Sirleaf.
Thank you all so much. Senator Kuhn, staff of all the many senators and congressmen who've been there with us, Nancy Lindberg, president of the Institute of Peace, Johnny Carson, former assistant secretary, the SIP also, friends of Liberia, members of the press, ladies and gentlemen. I'm here in Washington, here in the U.S. Capitol, to say thank you on behalf of the government and people of Liberia. And in my own name, I want to express profound gratitude to the U.S. government, to the U.S. military, the non-governmental organizations, the faith-based institutions, and the American people for the depth of friendship, remarkable partnership, and exemplary leadership which you have shown in joining us on the front line of the battle against this deadly disease. My brothers and sisters of neighboring countries in Guinea and in Sierra Leone, similarly afflicted by the outbreak, join me in expressing appreciation and thanks to all of you. As you know, it was March of this year, last year, that this enemy that we did not know, which we could not have prepared to confront, invaded our country, spread rapidly, and for the many of us, became more than an epidemic, threatening those who most intimately connected to the sick. Ebola robbed us of our human need to care and to be cared for. The cruelest of scourge deprived many individuals and stretched the sacred bonds of families, friends, and communities to the breaking point. It attacked our way of life as well as our health system, which gradually was rebounding from years of decline. Overstretched and overtaxed, our health system collapsed. Early in the epidemic, doctors and nurses, giving of themselves without proper gear, died, treating the sick and needy for what they believed to be a known disease, such as malaria and yellow fever. With each painful death, the hopes of a nation, only recently regenerated after years of war and destruction, faded to be replaced by understandable doubt and fear. The international predictions were grim and terrifying. We were told that before the end of January, at least 20,000 of our citizens would die every month in our three countries. Our economy froze and nosedived into recession, threatening to reverse the progress we had worked on and had worked so hard to achieve. Airlines stop their commercial traffic. Trade and travel routes were suspended. Contractors folded up their tents and left. And Liberians experienced the chilling effect of stigmatization and abandonment. The future of Liberia's peace and democratic stability, whose foundations we had diligently established, thanks to this virus, appeared tenuous and fragile. It was at this precarious moment, early in August, that I reached out to the government and people of the United States, that I reached out to you. I wrote to President Obama asking for America's support. I called my friends in Congress. Senator Kuhn, do you remember those phone calls? I know your staffers and your assistants and your schedulers will remember them. It was not just our friend from Delaware whom I awakened at night. I called Senators Jake Flake, Patrick Leahy, Minority Leader Pelosi, Congresswoman Karen Bass, Chairman Ed Royce, and maybe a dozen other congressional staffers. Well, America responded. You did not run from Liberia. As this country and people continue to do with many of our global challenges, America stood up, and America stood with us, providing the critical resources and partnership to enable us to fight back. That's exactly what the Liberian people did themselves. Community by community, religious leaders, tribal chiefs, women and youth groups, businesses, civil society organizations, political leaders across Liberia's 15 counties fought back. And so today, we are reclaiming the future that was once threatened by this deadly disease. And although we are not totally out of the woods, Ebola is no longer an unknown predator hunting the Liberian people. Thanks to your support, we are now hunting Ebola. From the White House, both houses of Congress, and both sides of the aisles, America responded. If I had the time, I would go door to door, thanking all 535 members of Congress. However, there's not enough time on this brief visit to do that.
This is Africa News Tonight. You are listening to the President of Liberia, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf.
Wherever you are. President Obama, thank you for your leadership. Thank you for sending Dr. Tom Frieden, Director of the Center for Disease Control, to Liberia. This decision was perhaps the single most influential event that awakened the world to the scope and magnitude of the disease virulent spread in West Africa. We also recognize the extraordinary decision by the president to deploy the U.S. military to help Liberia. They leave behind a capacitated national army that will not only be able to build treatment centers, but to build development structures all over the country. We want to give thanks to USAID DART and their team for the assistance in setting up an integrated command and to the many U.S. implementing partners, the first responders, who reached beyond their fears and ran toward the danger and not away from it. We give thanks to the U.S. Embassy in Liberia, Ambassador Deborah Malik. What did I call you? The diplomat general? For the steadfast support and continued compassion, walking with us every day, even when the joining seemed impossible. Liberians know that it was the leadership of the Obama administration, supported by Congress, by many, many senators and Congress, men and women, that allowed us to be able to stabilize the disease and encourage the rest of the world to respond to what truly was a global crisis. And so with support of partners like you, we have made great progress in containing the virus. Today, 13 of our 15 counties have reported no new cases over 21 days. And we are down to 1 to 3 infections per week, chasing the very last element of the chain of transmission. Notwithstanding, we have continued to warn our citizens against complacency. We can neither rest nor lift our foot off the gas. We are determined to get to zero cases by April 15, in keeping with the agreements recently reached by the Mano River Union Summit, the Mano River Union comprising Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Cote d'Ivoire, although Cote d'Ivoire is not affected. We are all keenly aware that traveling that last mile to zero new cases will be the most difficult because the disease has retreated and must now be chased down in every single corner. We also know that full eradication will not be achieved until the whole region is freed from Ebola. This is why securing our borders remains a priority, requiring additional resources as well as providing assistance to our neighbors. We remain confident of getting to zero because our 19 Ebola treatment units are virtually empty today. We now have the capacity to treat infectious disease. Our trained barrel teams can safely remove bodies in less than 24 hours. Our 5 active laboratories can test up to 61 persons per day. The 4,000 contact tracers, largely community workers, are now following thousands of persons who may be on the contact list. Friends, as we celebrate our success, the truth also is that the cost has been extremely high, too high for many grieving families in our recovering nation to bear. You may recall, many of you, on March 16, 2006, I had the honor to address a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress. I committed our leadership to paying any price to lay the foundation for durable peace in Liberia. Ebola struck after 10 years of consecutive peace, affecting that foundation that had been so carefully built. Our average annual growth rate at 7% experienced a 50% reduction. The infant mortality rate that we had brought down and the maternal mortality rate, which we had reduced by 17 years. Our crippling debt that we had been able to solve. The restoration of social and economic order and infrastructure. All of those, our free and democratic society, all stood the chance of being reversed. That was our challenge. We must now return to rebuilding Liberia's peace and prosperity, even as we eliminate the threat of Ebola. This requires updating the healthcare system, including an early warning system that integrates the public and private sectors. We have begun to do so, revising our 10-year healthcare plan with a heavy focus on training to rebuild and strengthen capacities that were lost during many of our frontline healthcare workers during the epidemic. We aim to strengthen the capacity of community workers to continue to give them what they need to be first responders so that never again will we be unable to guard against a disease of this nature. We are seeking to rebuild our health infrastructure, prioritizing roadways to health to access hard-to-reach areas. We are transitioning from treatment to prevention with the support of over 100 partners from 26 countries. Liberia's only 218 medical doctors and 5,234 nurses to serve a population of 4.3 million says that we have a big gap to be able to cover. And we know that these facts will not change overnight. We are determined to continue to fill that gap, gradually transitioning Liberian-built and led national healthcare delivery system that will withstand the size and scope of any other disease of this nature. There's also an inherent link between healthcare system revitalization, economic recovery, and peace building, which is stronger now than ever before. Liberia's post-Ebola economic recovery, while continuing to accelerate improvements in infrastructure, roads, electricity, water, and sewer, will prioritize healthcare delivery revitalization. We also intend to invest heavily in agriculture for food security and job creation. In this regard, we are working closely with USAID partners